Welcome to democracyonthemove.org, a podcast tribute to the people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it toward its true democratic principles. Content for this episode was recorded on Sunday, February 28, 2021. I'm Dan Schaefer, your host for today's podcast, and thank you for joining us today. Today we're talking with Olayemi Olorin, staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society of New York City. The Legal Aid Society is a 501c3 nonprofit legal aid provider based in New York City. It was founded in 1876, and it is the oldest and largest provider of legal aid in the United States. Its attorneys provide representation on criminal and civil matters in both individual cases and class action lawsuits. Its mission statement reads, "The Legal Aid Society is built upon one simple but powerful belief, that no New Yorker should be denied the right to equal justice." Olayemi Olorin is originally from the Bahamas and is currently a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society's criminal defense practice in Queens, New York. She's also a writer. Due to her work in the New York City court system, Olayemi sounds alarm bells that cause us to critically re-examine the criminal legal system. Most recently, she spoke out against the NYPD's physical abuse of her client, Carlisle Arnold. Democracy on the Move would like to emphasize that the views Olayemi Olorin expresses are hers based on her experiences and not that of any entity or organization with which she may be affiliated. Olayemi, welcome to Democracy on the Move, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Good. Well, I brought up Carlisle Arnold's name in the introduction. Could you briefly fill us in? Tell us who this man is and what happened and why the Legal Aid Society is working on his behalf.
So Carlisle is my client. On January 2nd, he was arrested and charged in Queens and charged with reckless driving of his ATV. And I arraigned him. And shortly after that, I realized that he'd actually been abused by officers from the 113th precinct, and there was video of that. So what had happened was he was riding his ATV. He was at a candlelight vigil for a friend. So a bunch of people were there riding their ATVs in celebration of the friend's life. NYPD comes and they tap his ATV, like, with their car. They physically hit his ATV. And so he stops his bike and he kind of stumbles off from being tapped. And immediately as he stumbles, several officers, more than three officers, tackle him to the ground. And then one of the officers, notably Officer Thomas Mentario of the 113th precinct, kneels on his neck. They're all on top of him. They're kneeling on all his body, but Mentario is kneeling on his neck and all of the bystanders are screaming bloody hell. Asking him to remove his knee, saying, "You have your knee on his neck," and he didn't lift it up. And that's notably the first known incident of that happening since the last summer when they passed a law forbidding officers from kneeling on people's neck following George Floyd's death and obviously Eric Garner. So we're trying to get the Queens DA's office to uphold their promises to hold officers accountable, charge them, and dismiss my client's cases. So that's what we've been going through now. But they're honestly acting a lot more like the officer's defense counsel.
That's a pretty tough fight, I imagine, because the union must be pretty strong there, correct?
They are. They are.
Yeah. So we're hearing a lot more about these types of things. I mean, you mentioned George Floyd, but even before George Floyd, we've been hearing, you know, as a nation, hearing more and more about how law enforcement is abusing their authority. And unfortunately, this is nothing new to our minority communities, but now it's getting an increasing amount of attention nationwide. And I don't know if this extra attention is because it's happening more often or the fact that more people are capturing these abuses on their mobile phone, on their mobile phones, or I suspect a combination of the two. So I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a lawyer, I'm just a layperson, but it seems that somehow between the codification of law and its enforcement, there's a severe breakdown. So you, as a lawyer working in the Legal Aid Society, can you give us some of your ideas on why there's this breakdown?
So that's the thing. I wouldn't call it a breakdown, right? Because we have this tendency to talk about these things as problems, right? But a lot of what is making the criminal system horrible and the issues with policing are not problems. They're problems for us, but they are being intentionally carried out. They're not random incidents. They're not mistakes. This is what it's deliberately. And, you know, people would like to look at it in the light most favorable to the police and say, you know, these are random incidents and these are, you know, issues that need to be reformed. But the reality is the police departments themselves all around the nation insist that these are not isolated incidents or these are mistakes because they defend all the behavior. They don't come out and condemn the activity and say these officers should be reprimanded and, you know, we're going to do our best to resolve this. No, they fight back. They resist. They say this isn't a problem. We should be allowed to do this. They fight against every reform effort, every policy that's put in place. So they're the ones making it clear to us that, you know, this isn't a mistake. This isn't an accident. So it's not an issue of, you know, getting rid of a few police or, you know, doing more implicit bias training. Statistics have shown that those trainings do nothing. And the officers and their unions themselves have said they do nothing. They don't want to be bothered with it. It's an issue instead with what policing is in this country and what the criminal system is made to function. So for me, I'm an abolitionist. I don't believe that these reform efforts do anything. Creating more laws that are just going to be end up being applied to poor Black and brown people isn't going to help. Creating more, giving the police more money and giving the prison and the courts more money doesn't do anything. Because if that was the case, we would live in the safest country on earth because we have the largest prison system. We have the largest incarcerated population. Our police departments are paid more than everything else. What we need to be working towards is abolition. And I mean this, that sounds radical when you first hear it, but there's an understanding this isn't going to be a tomorrow thing, right? In a world where I want these systems abolished, I don't think I'm going to snap my fingers and tomorrow it's all going to be gone. That's not practical and it wouldn't be realistic. What we're actually saying is it's a twofold thing. Instead of putting the money into the prisons and putting the money into incarcerating people and punishing the exact same people society's already failed, let's address the actual root problems, the actual social ills that we're turning into criminal issues. Let's put the money into the community itself, put it into education, put it into their mental health, put it into the infrastructure so that we create the conditions where people don't have to turn into these activities that you're saying are crimes or, you know, these issues that we're treating with the prison system that can only exacerbate those problems. Everything that prison and the courts and everything says is wrong is only fostered and made worse in the prison system. If somebody is violent before they're thrown into the criminal system, prison only breeds more violence. If somebody has mental health problems, it can only become worse. If somebody has trauma from their upbringing, what was their community, it can only get worse. And those things don't just affect those people. It affects their families, their communities. It creates a cycle. So the criminal system we have right now only fuels that. It's just a machine working exactly as it's intended. So for me, it isn't about any of these reform efforts. Those have been shown time and time again to do nothing. And for legislators, district attorneys' offices, police to resist them at every turn. So it really has to come now to slashing these budgets that we've given, these bloated budgets we've given to police departments, and putting that back in the communities.
That's interesting because, you know, I've said many times in this podcast, I'm an engineer, and so I look for solutions to problems. But I guess what you're really saying here is that this is really not a breakdown. This is more of a systemic thing that's been going on for a very long time. And that no matter how much training goes on in the police department, as you mentioned, they resist it. So that is not so. Kind of like thinking outside the box, I guess, is what you're saying. And we need to restructure everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Huh. Like, I'm looking at it from a perspective of we need to be solution oriented. Even if you're somebody that, you know, we live in a society that's been taught to believe anybody that's wrapped up in the criminal system is bad. You know what I mean? They're a criminal. There really is no innocent until proven guilty. People are not sympathetic to who they believe are the people that's in the system. They don't see the people there as me and you, and that they don't realize that people get arrested for getting into arguments with their mother in regular everyday activity. They don't realize that that's not what they're shown. So they're not inclined to be sympathetic. When you say, you know, I don't think there should be prisons and I don't think there should be this punitive system, they think, oh, Ted Bundy. And you know what I mean? The handful of whatever they see on TV, they're not interested in that. But if you're not interested in that argument, look at it from the perspective of what is this doing to help us, right? Like, right. How is this keeping us safe? How is this addressing the actual issues? And it's not, you know, I'm in the business of coming up with solutions. And instead of, you know, putting poor people in jail, let's figure out ways to create some situations where they aren't living in poverty, where they don't have to turn to crime, you know. Right. You see, you know, there's a community that's breeding violence and stuff, address that, you know. So that's what it really is about. It's not about trying to, you know, rob people of accountability or anything like that, or saying, oh, these people don't have any work to do or anything like that. It's about trying to create a system that's better for all of us. Right. And mm-hmm. the reality is that people don't talk about it a lot. They tend to talk about, oh, you know, keeping us safer and, oh, the community this. But the community that's being protected, quote unquote, police line poor communities. That's just the reality. That's where police are. You're not going to go in Long Island and see a bunch of police on every corner. But if you go to Brooklyn, you will. You're going to mm-hmm. see police everywhere. Those are the communities, Black and brown communities and poor communities, are the ones being policed. They're the ones, you know, having these negative experiences with the criminal system. So who exactly is being protected and being served when it's that community, the communities that are being policed, that are telling you the police abuse us, prison mm-hmm. hurts us. So those are the people that should be getting the say on what the criminal system looks like, because that's the reality of who's interacting with it.
Well, Can you point to any areas where you're seeing some of these reforms taking place, and or is this just something new or what? I mean, I can imagine
the reform. By reforms, you mean the reform efforts that I like don't agree with, or where
things that you agree with? Let's say like revectoring funds toward other things like education, mental health, and more of a social type of response to the issues, as opposed to just a military force via the police.
Right. Ohio, I think it's Ohio. I can't remember where specifically in Ohio off the top of the dome. I should have checked, but there is a place in Ohio that had already like slashed its police budget and stopped prosecuting certain crimes. It could be Ohio, it could be Jersey, an area in Jersey, but they had already taken this approach of kind of defunding the police and putting it into different, and not having like mental health provider, which is another big issue we have with police responding to mental health calls and issues. Jesus. But there have been places that have tried it. I know, and Seattle recently did something, but I don't know the specific cost of the dome, but there are places moving towards that.
Okay. And those are the places we should probably, you know, start tracking and seeing how successful it is. I can't imagine it not being successful. And, you know, I can sort of, if I may give you sort of an anecdote here, a personal anecdote, back in the late 80s, my mom used to work as a security guard for one of the state mental health facilities in St. Louis here. And it was a fairly large facility with hundreds of clients, and most of them were mentally slow, but there were also a sizable number of clients that suffered from mental illness. And during that time, it was like toward the end of the Reagan administration, funding for this state-run hospital was cut. And I remember at the time asking my mom about it, and I asked what's going to happen. And it was a painful topic for her because she really cared, you know, for the clients. And she'd gotten to know most of them, you know, personally. And she said, you know, she said, they're going to be pushed out onto the street, and it's going to be a problem for the police to handle. And in the years since, unfortunately, that I saw that she was right. You know, the police really are not prepared to handle these mental illness types of cases. And
they shouldn't be handling them.
Yeah, and they shouldn't be, right. So is there any, how about New York City? Is there any sort of a recourse for police officers to handle people with mental illness? Do they have like social workers working in that?
They do. The funny thing is, there are social workers, there are mental health professionals. If they wanted to put a system in place where they had those people respond to it, they could. But instead, they prefer to have the obscene budgets that they do, you know what I mean? Have NYPD handle these things. Because here's the thing, they don't have to handle the things the way that they do with our clients that have mental health issues. They choose to. I cannot tell you how many times I have represented somebody who a family member called because they wanted them to get help. They wanted them to go to the hospital. And the police will say, oh, we're just taking you to get some help just to go to the hospital. And the person will get treated, walk out the room, and they arrest them. Yeah, it happens constantly. Yeah. Yeah. It's constantly. And the system, and like I say, when you tell, you know, like these horrible stories, people think it's like, you know, something out of the ordinary or something obscene or something malfunctioned, but that is how it's done. And everything is set up in a way to prevent us from doing the thing that's helpful to our clients with mental health issues. And let me explain what I mean. They arrest our clients, mentally unwell people all the time, right? And you have an option. You know, if you talk to, you're talking to a client or a Raymond's and you realize like, okay, they're not all there. They have, you know, some issues. They should probably get a psych exam. They should get treatment or something. They shouldn't be having to stand through this case, or they're not competent enough to go through this case because they have mental health issues, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this, the avenue there is to ask for a 730 exam. That's a mental health examination, right? Mm-hmm. To say, and if they're found mentally unfit, then the case will be dismissed. But if we, to ask for that 730 exam, they have to be remanded. So you have to make a choice. Either I try to get my client, if I try to get my client a 730 exam to get them, you know, acknowledged as unfit and get them the treatment they want and get rid of this case. Now I send my client into Rikers. I put them through that trauma. I try to get them out. You're constantly in this position. If you want to put your client in a mental health court part because they need help or they need treatment, and they otherwise, these are poor people. They don't have health insurance. They don't have the ability to get these resources or these things that they need. And so you see this opportunity, okay, I want them to get this treatment. I want them to get this. But if you do that, now they're going to take some BS case that otherwise they have no business trying to drag out, or they wouldn't be able to prove it. It wouldn't be able to carry on. And they're going to drag it out for a year, and they're going to put your client, all of your client's ability to get rid of this case or do anything is going to be conditioned to how successful they are at completing whatever it is that the court arbitrarily determined that they need, not really what they're saying they need for their psychological treatment or what's wrong with them. They're not getting that. That say the court's saying you need to do this treatment, and if you don't do it, if anything's a little bit off, if you fail, if you relapse, anything like that, you know, you're doing it at the threat of criminal conviction or jail. And the issue with that is inherently, like, what mental health issues are, what substance abuse issues are, all these things, is relapse is a part of it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. People in the real world don't just magically, you know, one time through and then it's done. That's not how it is. Right. But the criminal court puts that on them. So It is deliberately set up in a way to make it unfeasible for us to go those approaches, for us to get our clients that kind of help that they really need. It's an accident.
It seems like a big failure for the system to really understand what it means to rehabilitate a person.
That's an important point, because the system's not in the business of rehabilitating anybody. It's a punitive system, purely.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see a law officer has basically weapons, and I've often said this, it applies to many places in life. If all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. Yeah. So you send a police officer to a situation that really doesn't require law enforcement. It requires, for lack of a better term, compassion.
Yeah.
And you're sending the wrong tool to do the job, basically.
Yep, exactly.
And I guess what you're saying right now is that even if you manage to get your client into a system that could possibly help him or her, the system itself says, doesn't understand what it means to rehabilitate, doesn't understand what it means to truly help a person in this situation.
It's not interested in doing that. That's just the reality.
And so that makes sense. I mean, in a sense that people talk about defunding the police, and you know, I got to tell you, I'm in the Midwest now. I was living on the West Coast for a long time. I'm now back in the Midwest.
Where in the Midwest?
Right near St. Louis, St. Louis, Missouri.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and I've gotten to know a lot of people here. I grew up here, moved to the West Coast, and lived out there for almost 30 years, and now I'm back. But when the phrase defund the police comes up, it's seen as a threat by a lot of people out in the you know, especially out in the rural areas where they don't get a whole lot of information except what comes to them through Fox News.
Yeah.
And they immediately think this is going to be anarchy, right? Because if you don't have any law enforcement, what do you have? You know, what use is it to write a law if you don't have law enforcement? But I think what the word that needs to really get out, though, is that the current way of funding the police is not really fixing a lot of the problems.
Right.
You know, somebody's speeding or somebody's, you know, committing a crime like robbing a bank or something. Obviously, you know, you need law enforcement there. And that's when the tools of the trade come into play, you know, the shields and the guns and so on. But most of these cases are really what you're telling me is this is it's the wrong tool to use. And so we're putting too much money into the tools of the trade, the guns and the badges, and not enough money into the compassion.
Right.
And
into addressing the issues that lead people there,
you
know, because that's what people, you know, they talk a lot about, you know, even people that are being sympathetic to the plight of your clients, it's always like, you know, people deserve a second chance. But what people don't realize sometimes is most of my clients didn't have a first chance, right? Like, they weren't in a good position, and then they ended up there. They were already not given the tools to succeed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People don't realize the majority of the criminal system, the vast majority of the criminal system are like wildly poor people.
Yeah.
You know, most people are represented by a public defender, and the income guidelines on how poor you have to be to qualify for our representation is extremely low. I myself wouldn't qualify for my own representation, and I identify as the poor.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. I would not be able to afford a lawyer. So people don't get that part. If people don't have anything, you know, we represent people. I've represented well over 500, 600, 700 people, and they're just poor people. You know what I mean? They're just people getting into arguments with their family, just everyday activity you would never realize could be a criminal issue is what it is, you know, like, oh, someone banged too loud on their door, you know, and now they're being charged with criminal mischief of the door, like because the door had a dent, banging too loud on their door because they got locked out. You know, those are the kinds of cases you have, and they don't drop, you know, they drag on. So that's really what the system, like the majority of cases in the criminal system are nonviolent. They're nonviolent, petty misdemeanor cases. That's what the majority of things are.
Mm-hmm.
But people can't pay bail. They're stuck in jail. They're forced to take a plea. Things get bumped up. They lose their jobs. It's just, it's not, there's nothing about the system that is, you know, innocent until proven guilty, because, you know, the allegations themselves could get you landed in Rikers indefinitely. You know, when you go to arraignments, the prosecutor and the judge discuss those allegations as fact. You know, most people just haven't picking up a case. They lose their jobs. People have immigration consequences. You know, undocumented clients have the fare of ICE, you know, it'll be a case that is a traffic infraction or going to get dismissed, but they still have to fare going to court because ICE is going to come grab them. It's just a whole myriad of ways the criminal system is just punitive at every single turn.
Yeah. And it's interesting in St. Louis here, that's becoming somewhat more visible to people here. You mentioned about the bail system and the fact that poor people can't afford bail, so they sit in the county jail, right? And now they lose their job, and now they have even less money, so there's no way they can make bail. And it becomes this, I would call it a cycle of doom. And the initial infraction could be something as simple as a parking ticket. Right.
Yeah.
And it just gets you into deeper and deeper trouble. They call it a poor tax here. You know, it's a tax on people that are poor, and it may not be it is a monetary tax, but it is more of a psychological tax you have to pay. There's recognition here in St. Louis. I'm not sure. I'd have to look at the latest news articles on this, but I know it's becoming a recognized problem in St. Louis, and there's people that are sworn to do things about it. Hopefully the same thing is happening in New York City there as well.
We had bail reform at the top of January 2020 that has made it a lot better. A lot of things have become, they're no longer eligible for them to set bail on, so that's good. although in the middle of the pandemic, Cuomo rushed through a rollback on some of those bail reform efforts. But it's better. It's better than it was.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, we do have a fractured nation, and we have a nation now that has gone that is going through COVID. Hopefully, it'll be out sometime this year. We'll get over it, and life returns to, I guess, a new normal. And this has really taxed us a lot. But the main thing is that we're a fractured nation at this point. And that being the case, it's really difficult to get the word out that you're trying to get out. In a sense, is that, you know, we need to reform the way that we do law enforcement, reform the way that we handle people that need help. What is being done? What is being done from your perspective to recruit the masses to help change the system?
So, you know, I don't think that we are a fractured nation any more than we have been. You know, this idea, people love to say, you know, America's more polarized than it's ever been. And, you know, race is dividing us more than it ever has. And that's not true. You know what I mean? If you ask the people who've always been experiencing America in all its glory and its ugliness too, and the people that experience racism, this has always been it to the extreme. The only difference is now we're able to get everybody else in the conversation, and there's some, it's at least realized on some level that it's incumbent upon all of us, you know what I mean, to be a part of this conversation. All of us are aware that this is an overarching theme that we're moving towards. So in actuality, I think a lot has changed in the sense that we're talking about, you know, abolition. We're talking about, you know, defund police. We're talking about all these things. Abolition isn't new. Wanting to abolish the prison system is an old school of thought that's been around. You know, Angela Davis has been talking about this for forever. Leaders have been, but it's been, you know, a scholarly term. Academics are talking about it. Niche audiences and groups and organizers are talking about it. But now, whether or not, you know, it seems like there's this opposition, of course there is. Any resistance to the status quo and any new idea is gonna be greeted with fear by everybody. But the reality is, at least everybody is hearing it, everybody's talking about it, and that's progress. That in and of itself, that it's a mainstream talking piece, that politicians are arguing about it, that, you know, there's any kind of support for it, that's a swell. That's a major swell in support, actually, because abolition's been discussed, and it wasn't until and defund the police and these efforts, you know, just became big on the main stage as of last year. So I would actually say we're doing well, you know, where it's about educating people. You know, you can't fault people for what they don't know. Mm-hmm. A lot of why America's criminal system is able to be the way it is and operate in plain sight is because people have lived in a society with incessant propaganda. You know, every time you turn on the TV, any news, anything you watch is just talking to you like the police is oxygen and water. And, you know, anything that they do, all this brute force, all of this is necessary and just, and the people they do it to are bad people. That's what you see everywhere. So of course people are going to think that. They're not really exposed to anything different. But as people learn more, as people hear more ideas, as people are exposed to more, they'll become radicalized against it. You know, they might not, everyone's not going to move all the way over to an abolitionist principle, but more people will move along closer to the idea that, okay, what we have here is a problem, and a major problem in this, what we have needs to be eradicated in some way. So I think we're doing well, actually.
That's, you've actually lifted my spirits a little bit here, because, you know, I've never looked at it this way. The first step toward fixing a problem is recognizing the problem. And I guess what you're saying at this point, we're recognizing the problem as a nation. Now we're talking about these things. Wow. Okay. Yeah. I like that. So it's painful, though. I mean, it's painful. And I think it's painful in the sense that all Americans are now getting involved in this. And but you're seeing the silver lining around the dark cloud there. I like that. So let's go to the call to action section. What can our listeners do to support the Legal Aid Society of New York?
You know, I think everybody has a different role to play. Everybody has a different lane. But I think you know, less about supporting legal aid. Legal aid, we're good. Let's support the bail funds. Let's donate to the bail funds, because helping our clients is what will help us, help us do our jobs, help us be effective. Get more involved in these DA elections. Manhattan has a important election coming up for district attorney, and look out for people like Eliza Orleans and Dan Court that are running, and try and get elected more people that are gonna push us more to the vision that we're trying to see. I think people forget sometimes about local politics and all these different things, but those are what really matters, because what's happening in the system, all the things, the terrible things that happen in the criminal system, happen because of legislators and prosecutors and judges, and a lot of these and things are elected positions. So if you want to help legal aid, by help our clients, help help the Black and Brown people in New York City, help the poor people by focusing on getting involved in these local elections and what's happening there.
Okay.
So that's what they can do for us.
That's good. What is the, when you say support the bail funds, what does that mean?
Oh, donate to the bail funds. We have local bail funds in New York City that will post bail for clients that don't have the money for bail. So we'll apply for them and the bail funds will pay their bail.
Oh, okay.
And they survive off of donations.
Oh, that's good. That helps solve that small but significant problem. Well, I guess it is a significant problem, but it's just one of the many problems. But certainly helping bail out people who can't afford it is a good thing.
It is.
Wow. Well, Elaimi, thank you for stopping by to talk to us today. I really appreciate it. We've been talking with Elaimi Aluren, a staff attorney at the Legal Aid Society's Criminal Defense Practice in Queens, New York, and a writer. Elaimi, thank you for joining us today and giving our audience your insight to some of the issues of law enforcement, and especially want to thank you very much for the hard work that you're doing toward making this world a better place for everyone.
Thank you so much, Dan. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Democracy on the Move, a tribute to all those people and organizations who dare to reimagine our nation and drive it back to its true democratic principles. Please tune in each week, where we will feature guests and topics that will help keep you in touch with our march toward a more perfect union. If you have any suggestions or stories that you think we should be covering at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through our website contact page at democracyonthemove.org/contact, or send us an email at info@democracyonthemove.org. You can also comment on our Twitter page at All on the Move. If you find today's podcast interesting and informative, please tell your friends and family about us. And if you would like to help sponsor the podcast at Democracy on the Move, please contact us through the website or email. I'm Dan Schaefer, producer of the podcast, and I'd like to thank you for tuning in. It's been my pleasure to be with you today. Please have a safe week ahead, and we hope you'll tune in to our next show.